Electric bicycles are my jam. I'm turning into a nut for a good e-bike. It's easy to get around, we save gas not driving our car for short trips to the store, and I'm getting a little extra exercise. The folks at Velotric are sponsoring a series of videos on my channel to show off some affordable e-bikes and help people get up to speed. It's easier than you think, and prices have never been more competitive. You can catch those videos on my YouTube channel, but if you're interested in shopping an e-bike, head over to velotric.bike/somegadgetguy and look at their road bikes and fat tires. Again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. If any of those bikes look good to you, you can save an additional $60 off an already low price by using the coupon code SOMEGADGET60, SOMEGADGET60 at checkout. Once again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy and coupon code SOMEGADGET60, and I thank Velotric for being a sponsor on this show. Live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, a.k.a. Some Gadget Guy, the SGG of this terribly named podcast series. But the important part is that QA, we're doing question and answer, and I'm going to need the chat's help on this one. This is maybe the most science-y show I've ever tried to put together with my limited understanding of advanced material science and physics. If it were all about audio topics, I would feel qualified to really share insight on these scientific discoveries. None of these discoveries have anything to do with audio, so my ears are no help. But there's been some crazy stuff happening in the world of superconducting elements and also in nuclear fusion. So we've got to talk about some of that stuff. And then we also had a pair of stories just breaking about some shenanigans happening with broadband distribution and the FCC. And so I do not have a proper gadget block for this week's show. We've got a really heavy and loaded news block. So when we get into sort of the second half-ish of the podcast where we'd normally veer off and start talking about gadgets and stuff, I will let the chat lead us wherever we want to go. It took me so much longer to put this one together just because I was literally having to also wiki and search for some of the proper definitions of these elements and materials. So that was a really rambling preamble. Hey, everybody! I'm glad to see the chat's already kicking up here. Farhan is curious about the Qualcomm news. And Farhan, a word on the street. I don't know if someone can confirm this, but I believe it's Farhan's birthday. So if everybody in the chat, some people in the chat already have wished Farhan a happy birthday. Happy birthday, Farhan. Thank you for spending some time in the live stream of this geeky podcast. We could run down the list here. I see Dave Burns, Lyndon. I see Greg, Kappa Cash, Al Sabakli. We've got Tech Boy. Did I say Greg? I think I said Greg all. Frank Gallo, Lamprose, Bryant. Lyndon, I'm probably repeating and missing people. J-Man, JMX Warrior. Did I say Dave? I think I said Dave. Woo, science! Yeah, science! Mountain Dew Lou is saying hello. Simon says hypno. We got some more happy birthdays coming in for Farhan. That's exactly what I want to see. You guys are so sweet. Y'all are so sweet. Old Trev, Juice3250, Greg all baked you three cakes. Emoji cakes. But baked you three cakes. And also, I want to throw a shout out to Anderspand, subscribing with Prime. Subscribed for 19 months. You get the terrible one, doesn't have a soundboard. Celebration. Thank you so much for supporting production on this live stream. Everybody, happy Monday. We like to hang out on Mondays and get a good sort of lead into the week. This week is going to have a whole bunch of crazy tech news, but last week did too, and there were a lot of headlines. It took me some time to kind of wrap my brain around. That's also why I like to hold my podcast on a Monday. It gives us a little more time just to sort out our feels and see what's going on with some of these stories, not just knee-jerk react to some of the headlines. I want to start this week off just in lieu of, I'm going to do housekeeping, but we're going to blitz through. There were so many links on housekeeping this week. The dam is starting to crack on some of these sponsored videos that I've just been locked up on. And some of these things are really, really fun to talk about. So we're gonna cover that. But I also did just want to check in. The community that I used to promote every week, like, I'm having to go through even my audio podcast because I'd forgotten I'd add these little, like, ads and bumpers on things for, like, the Glowing Rectangle subreddit. And I still haven't brought back that subreddit. I don't feel like Reddit has made any changes that will benefit that community. And in fact, it really harms the way that we share content on Glowing Rectangles. But I had another just lurking in the DMs conversation with yet another content creator over the weekend that was really disheartening. Like, another person facing burnout, probably going to be walking away from their channel. At the same time, having another conversation with someone who's looking at, like, a severe redirect for how they talk about tech. And it really has been exhausting online. And a big part of this is, like, now we're inundated with multiple social media accounts that we've got to supply and churn content for, and it feels like algorithms are stomping on our neck, and it really is that call to action. I've been making it, like, every week, but it really is that call to action where if there's someone you like, especially if they're not a humongous media organization unto themselves, if they're, like, a solo tech commentator, those are the people that are just getting crushed right now in this era of constant churn, disposable YouTube content, but audiences demand high production value. This stuff is really burning people out. And they're not going to tell you publicly. A lot of them are not going to reach out to their communities for much assistance or for much explanation. Unfortunately, what's likely to happen is they're going to fizzle. So, you know, maybe they just take an extended vacation and then they stop producing for a while, and then it's really nice not having to keep up with that grind. But when they come back, YouTube has destroyed their channel. YouTube has become the most punitive force in this toxic algorithmic application of squeezing content creators for more and more juice. I mean, we're talking blood from stones. So this is the for two content creators who shall remain unmentioned, because I'm sure they don't want me outing their mental health issues. If there's someone you like, you've got to actively support them. You've got to, like, do more than just passively watch a video of theirs every now and then. You got to do more than just, well, I clicked the subscribe button, because YouTube isn't going to help you. I'm putting together, I think it's just going to be an article. I don't think I need to turn everything into a video, but it's time to revisit things like the RSS feed reader, right? That geeky bit of content organizing for yourself where you can make your own feed of media. Because if you really like the work that these smaller content creators are putting out, even on a service like YouTube, you will not be notified by YouTube unless they only churn the most keyword popular SEO verified kinds of titles. And I don't know about y'all, but, like, you know, we might talk about it a little bit more in the gadget block, but I've been playing with these brains for little portable AR glasses. Videos that just say X-Real Beam or Rokid Station, how much fun to use AR glasses, those videos are tanking. The videos that are like Apple Vision Pro, you can do that today. The Apple experience, you can do that on AR. The stupidest clickbaity stuff is getting more traffic. So, again, YouTube has yet again ratcheted that kind of keyword algorithmic sorting. And they are. They are a gatekeeper in between the content creator and their subscribers and their audience. So if you would like to evade all of that, it is actually pretty easy. You have to make an effort. And that's the thing is I've noticed I reach out to content creators and I say, hey, if we work together, we can really make this better. And they're like, yeah, that's great, totally. And then they hear that, like, oh, you actually have to do something. And then they all just bugger off. And that was the failure of Glowing Rectangles until I automated a whole bunch of it. It's like, yeah, if you come to this subreddit and share your own link, other people will help promote and, and share it. Oh, I have to do something. You won't just give me internet traffic for doing nothing. And so this whole like facade of content creators are out there helping each other. Nah, it's all BS. We all love to collaborate. Nah, not really. I'm gonna take a drink of coffee before I get legit bitter. Oh wait, Juice 3250 subscribed to Prime. You too get the terrible Juan does not have a soundboard. I don't know why I do guns for the horns. You see how I do that? Because it should be, but instead I do. But I do gun fingers. Thank you for supporting the podcast. I really appreciate it. Now I'm gonna get a drink of coffee here. Goat V8. I don't know if it's just me, but my homepage recommend has been especially cappy this last two or so weeks. I feel like that is a sentiment that a lot of people have been sharing about the quality of the recommendations coming from YouTube. And I know there are a lot of people who get really up in their feels about things like YouTube Premium and supporting content creators by watching ads. I am much more in the gray. I would very much appreciate it if you watched my videos while watching ads or subscribing to YouTube Premium. We have a story about YouTube Premium. This is why I'm kind of laying on this a little bit. I might change my order. We might just go and straight talk about YouTube Premium, kick off the news block. But the reason why I'm not taking a hard stance against ad blockers, I don't believe you are really stealing from me if you watch my video without an ad blocker. I don't believe you are stealing from me if you watch my video with an ad blocker. If you do that, I would very much appreciate actual sweat equity support, doing more than just clicking a thumbs up button. Give it a share. If you liked the video and you didn't watch an ad, it actually helps me more to signal boost that video than you watching an ad. And one of the reasons why I'm not joining some of my friends, and I'm talking very close friends who are passionate about this argument about not using ad blockers on YouTube. I have no control over the ads that are served on my videos. That's actually one of the reasons why I've been taking up more sponsored videos, because those are companies I vetted, I'm doing some interesting work with, I appreciate their products, and I think you'll find them interesting too. I've worked that relationship to try and create content that I think the audience will find interesting. As we're ramping up to another season of toxic political coverage, and YouTube has walked back from their commitments to police weaponized misinformation on their platform, I cannot guarantee you won't be served terrible ads on my channel. I have no control over it. I have no say over it. I have no input. And I don't feel that that is appropriate for the mental health of my viewers. I know for the last presidential election, every time I would go to YouTube, it was some of the most toxic alt-right, far-right wing, super conservative, reactionary, and borderline fascist advertising every single time I went to YouTube. And I couldn't evade it. There's no way on YouTube to say, I don't like this ad. There's no control mechanism. You're sort of beholden. And I do not appreciate this argument that YouTube knows, Google knows everything about me. Google could leverage their knowledge of my behavior to serve me ads from companies I would love to do business with. They have all of that information. But instead, they're choosing to serve me ads that they know will upset me. That harms my mental health, right? It's also a disservice to the companies that are paying YouTube for advertising, that they are regularly being used as the pain point to get people to consider subscribing to YouTube Premium. So this process of YouTube Premium hasn't really made YouTube better. It's just that free YouTube is continuously being made worse so that you'll be encouraged. You're getting negged into subscribing and paying money to make it better. This is not an argument that I feel holds water with my friends, the people that are out there that really get passionate about things like using ad blockers. I can only make my decisions for how I choose to interact with the platform and how I feel it's best to support the people I follow, and trying to put my money where my mouth is by doing things like setting up social media communities to try and signal boost and share their content instead of just passively watching a video and going, huh, that was cool, I gave them a view. This is a very complex and complicated and emotionally charged conversation, and everybody's going to come to their own conclusions on all of these situations. I can only share how I feel. If I had any input on the ads that you were served on my videos, I would probably be doing less sponsored videos, and two, I think I would be a bit more aggressive in this conversation. But like I said, especially as it pertains to the mental health of my audience, and also knowing that it is very challenging out there right now. The economy is not in good shape and people are struggling with inflation, and I don't think feel it's appropriate to say, hey, even though YouTube could make this amazing for you and serve you ads that you would really be interested in, and bundle you with services that you would really care about because they know everything about you and your behavior and your shopping, just sit through some terrible ads. I can't ask you to do that. I really can't. The increasingly left-wing, as I get older, I get more and more radicalized in my behavior against these monolithic, you know, billion and trillion dollar corporations. I can't in good conscience ask you to do that. It doesn't make sense. And then also, you're not going to come into my video wanting to watch that video. So, no, that's not how we're going to play this. Ghost Starscream, do you believe that ad blocking equals piracy? That is a very complicated question, and there is a spectrum of reactions, and there is a spectrum of conversation surrounding that. I believe if you have a relationship with the content creator where you can deliver feedback and the content creator can act on what's being delivered, then yes. If the content creator has no control over the platform and what the platform chooses to pair with those videos, then I do not believe that is a direct circumvention of the content creator's ability to monetize. That is a non-answer. I can't give you a better answer than that because I don't feel there is one. It is not as cut and dry as, you're taking money out of my wallet by not watching ads. Because also, like, monetization on YouTube is garbage right now, especially for medium-sized channels like mine, and especially if you're not just keyword packing and only making videos about Apple and Samsung. In the tech space, everyone else is getting squeezed bad. And that's the reason why you see so much struggling with this, like, oh, but everything is a Samsung Galaxy or an iPhone. Because that's what triggers the algorithm to really put your content out to your viewers' subscribe feeds. I can't tell you the number of people that come to my channel and leave comments like, I had no idea you were still making videos. It is really disheartening. YouTube has flipped the switch. They are no longer a content discovery platform. They are an algorithmic sorting platform. They're just the same as like a Facebook, in my opinion now. So, Ghost Starscream, it's not a question I can give you a clear answer on. It is a case-by-case, video-by-video, article-by-article kind of conversation. And for, you know, like an outlet like Ars Technica, as they do, I think they're trying to build in a little bit more on like affiliate links and marketing. And if I see something cool, I try to go through there. I try not to block ads on the websites that I really go to. I try to use my RSS feed reader now more instead of like the Google feed of content when you swipe to the side on your home screen on your Android. It matters more, I feel, that you make the effort to support than whether or not you come down to some kind of clinical binary decision on whether or not this question has an answer. And that's the best I can do. Let me take another drink of coffee here, and then we can do a little quick housekeeping. Okay. Ron Guido, I wish I had an answer to this too. How does it affect you when a person watches part of a video and then picks it up later on? YouTube won't give us that data. I bet you YouTube says, oh, they stopped watching, that's bad. And then when you go back to watch it, oh, they only watched part of the video. You didn't keep consistent watch time on your video. I bet you everything, unless you've got millions of subscribers, anything short of your video didn't trigger someone to stay on YouTube for an hour is bad. At this point, that's what it seems like. Unless you can give us an amazing time on site with one video, then, and it encourages people to keep clicking on videos, then your video isn't getting shared to your subscribers. It really feels like that's the ratchet point that we've arrived at. I'm way behind on this chat. Dave Burns, meanwhile, I am eyeing an X-Real pair of glasses for Steam Deck gaming. Let me say, well, we can absolutely dig into some AR glasses later on. I've been spending a lot of time with both camps. I've been having so much fun putting displays on my face. Speaking of, that is kind of what this whole last week was for SomeGadgetGuide.com. Let me just run the gamut on this. So we started, where is it? We started with the X-Real Beam. I was actually out on my road trip, so this one went out during the road trip, but I just want to highlight the X-Real Beam is an interpreter. It's a little box that connects to the X-Real Air glasses, and you use it with another computer. And this has all of the sensors and telemetry and the computational power to add head tracking to any display, any computer, or any game console that you want to hook it up with. So if, like on a phone that has video output, like here's my Moto. My Moto has video output, I pair the glasses, and I can use the Nebula app, and I can stick a window in space in front of me, and if I look away, there's nothing over there, but then I look back, there's the window. So that's cool. This phone can tackle that all by itself. You don't need another box. But if I plug my... Oh, my glasses are behind me. But if I plug my glasses into my Steam Deck, well, the Steam Deck doesn't deliver all of that information, and it doesn't have an X-Real app to manage all of the head tracking from the little sensors in the glasses. So what I do is I take my X-Real Beam and I pair it with my Steam Deck, and now I can pin my gaming window in one place, and if I look away, the gaming window stays where I pinned it, and then I can look back. So it simulates that experience of like having a TV floating out in space in front of you. It's not fully occupying your field of view no matter where you look. This is a very specific kind of solution. It does not really do anything on its own yet. X-Real is saying they're going to bring some apps to it, but right now, this is just a Swiss Army knife display converter, and it works wired or wireless over Miracast. Back to the housekeeping. The next week, we started playing with the Rokid Station. So Rokid makes their own fancy glasses. I know I've been speaking a little bit more about N-Real and X-Real, but Rokid is, I think, their sort of top competitor in this space right now. And the Rokid Station is the polar opposite. This delivers no head tracking or body anchoring or any additional like movement or smoothness or stabilization. This is purely an Android TV in a little battery-powered container. It's like a Chromecast that lives in your pocket, and it powers an Android TV for your glasses. But because this is Android TV, you can install any app you want to install on an Android TV, which brings me to my follow-up video. I love this. My follow-up video was using it with Steam Link. So walking around the house, we've played with a bunch of these experiments before. Hey, you want to send your... So I've got this beefy PC right here, right? I've got a workstation. It's got a decent GPU in it. I can do some pretty good gaming on it. And then I use Steam Link, and I can send it to like my TV in the living room if I want. Well, these days, my TV is often occupied by stuff that my wife wants to watch and stuff that my daughter wants to watch. And if I want a game on a bigger screen, I kind of have one in my office, but I don't like gaming where I work. It's a psychological, like, I gotta get out of this little room. I spend so much time in this little room. Well, now I can take these glasses and the Rokid station and pair a little Bluetooth game controller. Do I have it over here? Not. I think it's on the shelf behind me. I can pair a Bluetooth game controller with this, and then I can run my game from my beefy workstation and game on a screen that rivals the biggest TV in our house, anywhere in our house. And it works surprisingly well over Wi-Fi. Funnily enough, it also works really well with the Steam Deck. So I can run the game from the Steam Deck and then play it anywhere I want on the biggest virtual screen that I can play with. So it's a real head trip. I'm getting question after question after question of people who, this stuff is really unfamiliar. These glasses, these brains for these glasses, like, even if you think you're super techie and you've been keeping up with, like, VR headsets, this stuff is still evading a lot of people out there. And I've been getting a lot of questions like, well, which one would you buy? And you're like, well, in a way, kind of both. And if like, because of the DRM on Android TV, unfortunately, your main streaming services don't work this way. But if, like, let's say most of your video streaming is on something like a Plex server, like I've got all my Blu-ray rips on my NAS, and then I use that to run Plex, I can generate the video from the Rokid station and then send that video to the X-Reel Beam, and then the X-Reel Beam can do the head tracking to the X-Reel glasses. And that's really silly, but it does kind of work. But if you go like Disney Plus, like if you try and stream Disney Plus or Amazon or Hulu or anything like that, this combo breaks the DRM on Android TV. So a little sneak peek. I've got another video I'm planning probably coming out next week, not this week, but next week. And then I had a couple of editorials on somegadgetguy.com. I finally cleaned up and publicly posted. This was a production diary on Patreon, but now it's public. Can the Pixel tablet change my mind about smart displays? Just some early thoughts using the Pixel tablet. Trying to kind of dig into the main claims that Google is making about their Slate and their dock and their speaker experience. And then on the Patreon, I have a production diary just talking about some of those differences that I just spelled out here. So I kind of spoiled this editorial, but if you were on Patreon, you were able to kind of catch some of my thoughts talking about AR glasses, the Rokid and the X-Reel, and how I kind of missed the boat. I was expecting one product to be more popular than the other, and I thought techies would really want to see one thing over the other thing, and I was kind of wrong, like legit hardcore wrong about what the audience was more interested in. And then this one is probably going to get polished up and posted sometime later this week on somegadgetguide.com. But this is a follow-up, this is an update, excuse me. This is an update to a situation where I haven't been able to produce this kind of content, all because Apple keeps breaking things and other people need to fix what Apple breaks. So we all suffer when Apple products don't just work. And I get real bitter talking about AirTags. So someone accused me of bullying Apple a couple nights ago. You're like, no, this is fair criticism of how Apple went about trying to make something unique to their ecosystem that then had a pretty expected consequences for everybody else. The second AirTags came out, a lot of us were saying like, hey, there are some glaring oversights here that should have been addressed by working with, like, you know, the Bluetooth special interest group, the Bluetooth SIG. And instead, now it's breaking other companies' ability to compete because now everyone's super concerned about privacy and location data and stalking and all this stuff. But Apple's still selling AirTags. So while the whole rest of the industry is trying to fix what Apple broke, Apple still gets to profit by being the de facto standard in location tag tracking now. And you're like, you know what? That's really not fair. And there are few market corrections for when Apple goofs at scale like that. And someone else was trying to argue like, oh, but, you know, everyone could have just, you know, used Apple. Apple tried to put it out as a standard and everyone could have used it. And you're like, no, I don't think it's right to say you have to license Apple's MFI tech and pay Apple just to be a part of their ecosystem. And if I were an Android owner, that's not what I would want. It's kind of the philosophy behind having a competition, a competitive point, is give Apple all of the money and let them dictate every single standard is not a good business strategy and doesn't work out to delivering better consumer products. But yeah, it's funny, like some of the Apple stands have really been crawling out of the woodwork on some of this stuff that, like, it's kind of like the Samsung Knights have died down a little bit just because I don't feel this last Unpacked was super exciting. Like really good iterative improvements to products, but nothing that like blew the doors off mobile technology. And without that excitement, I don't feel like the Samsung Knights are emboldened to be as terrible online. But instead, now as we're leading up to the next round of iPhone announcements, the Apple people are getting much more aggressive and much more defensive against any criticisms of the company. It's funny how there's like an ebb and flow to that kind of toxic energy online. I also have to throw another shout out. Did I miss one? I think I saw someone else. I'm sorry, I'm on the Twitch chat right now. Gabaletta, another subscriber to Prime. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the support. And that's really awesome of you. Subscribe for 22 months. That's amazing. Thank you so much. You're rad. Everybody supporting this podcast, you're rad. Rad people. Again, it doesn't have to be through subscriptions like this. Support is rad. Simon says, no, the Apple Knights have been alerted. hold on. Farhan, about Pixel tablet, it could be a worthy solution for Android-powered point. It could be a worthy solution for Android-powered point-of-sale machine. I do see a lot of them running Android. I think overwhelmingly the most popular options are iPads. And that actually is kind of a cool use of an iPad. I can't lie about that. I do miss the days where you could have like a headphone jack, square, card swiper, but barring the whole headphone jack debate, that is actually kind of a cool kiosk. I'll be curious to see if these initiatives trying to get Android back into tablet-y stuff really start generating some momentum. Because one of the stories we're going to talk about is kind of the not so great e-waste side of planned obsolescence for things like Chromebooks. So, all right, why don't we get into some news? I'm gonna take another drink of coffee here. Everything that we're gonna be talking about, all of the housekeeping, all of the show notes, all of the links, everything's gonna be available on this week's blog post on somegadgetguy.com. Episode 310. 310 episodes. Whew. All right, let me take that drink of coffee.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Mmm, savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to SomeGadgetGuy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
Oh, and one more. Q3 Becker, Steve, thank you so much. Subscribe to Tier 1 on the Twitch. This is the worst celebration of people subscribing. Happy SDGQA. Subscribed for 42 months. 42, the answer to life, the universe, and everything. Answering the question, what do you get if you multiply 6 by 9? All right. Excuse me. Do we want to... I'm gonna flip the order. Usually I say if there's a political story, we're going to start with politics. Funnily enough, I just want to pat myself on the back here. This week is really has some political stories, has a lot of sciencey stories, and every single link is not from Ars Technica. Ha ha! Most of them are. Dave Burns, 5 years from now, Juan will finally have Twitch alerts. Everyone, I need you, I mean, maybe even screenshot this. I'll pause for just a second. I guarantee you, this comment from Dave Burns will age like milk. 5 years from now, something tells me my live stream is going to be even more low-tech than it is today. I love it. No, I'm going to stick to my guns here. We do have a YouTube story, and that's talking about the enhanced bitrate. Let me knock out these FCC stories, because I want to condense both of them. They're super frustrating. They really cheese me off. Cup of Cash, this podcast is not sponsored by Ars Technica, but I am happy to support an outlet that I think does phenomenal journalistic coverage of things like the internet, internet service providers, and broadband distribution. My nerdy political tech man crush, John Brodkin, I think wrote both of these. Yep, John Brodkin. I just set up an alert for everything that he does. I'm kind of cyber-stalking him. He's super cool. Internet providers that won FCC grants try to escape broadband commitments. So we covered this a little while ago. The FCC is giving out taxpayer dollars to help fund rural... This is the Rural Digital Opportunity Fund, the RDOF. We have a lot of people that we can't even measure who are falling way behind the tech curve, have almost no access to any kind of modern-day telecommunications equipment. And they're the people who are the most expensive to get set up. So ISPs, while they boast and brag about how much money and how much profit they make every fiscal quarter, and they continue to do things like jack up rates and lobby for additional fees, and they have two lobbying organizations that collectively represent all of the larger and smaller internet service providers around our country, are constantly heading up to our elected officials with their hands out looking for more tax dollars. Instead of saying, well, you know, you're managing this internet connection, you need to build in the costs and let your shareholders know. Instead, they just go and say, oh, but we need more tax dollars. So while we tack on more fees to not really do much improvement to your connection, we also need more money from the government to subsidize our profits for our shareholders. And that's the relationship that we've been sort of stuck in, really ratcheted up during the Trump administration with the FCC under Ajit Pai. So wouldn't you know it, in late 2020, the FCC tentatively awarded $9.2 billion over 10 years, $900 million a year, for 180 internet providers that agreed to deploy broadband to over 5.2 million unserved homes and businesses. But after seeing evidence that the program was mismanaged under former chairman Ajit Pai, the current FCC reevaluated the grants and authorized payments of $6 billion to a smaller group of ISPs. And now, if you read through this article, it goes through the entire list of shenanigans that even these contractors who put in estimates and said, hey, this is how much it's going to cost. This is how much money we're going to need. It's a grant. They're getting this money from the government, which means they're taking it out of our wallets as taxpayers. And, you know, now it's going to be kind of hard. It's not going to be as easy as we said it was going to be. And it's going to cost us more. And we need more money to do what we said we could do. And we might make less profit if we do it the way that we said we could do it. So you need to give us more money so we don't lose out on more profit. And it's a joke. At this point, as I've mentioned, as I'm getting increasingly radicalized to the left, we need an overhaul of this entire system. And if a company really can't deliver on their promises and improve the service and stay competitive in the 21st century, I feel this all needs to be handed back to the taxpayers. We have paid for fiber to home several times over, and we've let local politicians, state and city representatives craft laws that prevent us from really getting things like fiber to home. We keep getting promised things like, oh, 5G is going to revolutionize. Not if you don't have the backhaul, not if you don't light up the fiber, not if you don't improve the actual internet connection to the tower. It doesn't matter if you stick a faster Wi-Fi router on your DSL, you still have DSL. So it's not going to happen by going to space. It's not going to happen by setting up 5G towers in rural communities. The only thing that's going to fix this issue is really getting fiber to home and to get what we've paid for. And if the companies can't do it, then we need to take this stuff back. It needs to just be a public infrastructure. It just needs to be a part of this. And every single time we've seen taxpayer-funded broadband, wouldn't you know it, it is substantially better at a much lower cost than letting all of these companies operate on their own for profit. They end up just being sort of blood-sucking middlemen. They don't really deliver a better solution. They deliver a worse, more expensive solution. So it's pretty rough. Dave Burns. But rural electrification and telephone service cost too much money. Wait a minute. So, Dave, I don't know that I'll ever really get this project off the ground, but we have a lot of family in rural New Mexico. And in rural New Mexico, you often find these pockets of urbanization surrounded by Native American reservations. And let me tell you, I'm sitting in the movie theater to watch Barbie, and there were two different ads served before Barbie, before the trailers, about local organizations that are still continuing to fight the federal government over the nuclear testing happening during the days of Oppenheimer because of the government coming in eminent domain, kicking people off their land, not hiring people from those local communities that they displaced, not giving them adequate protection to work with nuclear materials. Wouldn't you know it, there was a whole surge of fatalities and cancers and health issues. And then irradiating whole stretches of land. And in the movie Oppenheimer, he's like, I want to give it back to the people after you nuked the crap out of it. And we're talking about communities of people here in this country that are on sovereign land who keep getting displaced if their sovereign land turns out to be valuable to the government. Oh, we found cool stuff on this land. Got to kick you off again. You can't benefit from it, and you won't build wealth on it. We're going to kick you off and make you even more poor and destitute. And there are communities around rural New Mexico that you don't have guarantees on electricity, running water, telephone service of any kind, let alone advanced cell phone service. And it's pretty brutal out there. I mean, it's rough living. So it would be nice. It would be nice if we actually held American exceptionalism up to that lens and said, hey, we can celebrate some of these historical achievements and stuff, but let's not completely whitewash out all of the people who were hurt by this. I have to laugh because otherwise I'd be screaming and crying. Hold on, let me drink some more coffee. Aditya, yes, absolutely. I am become death, destroyer of fertile soil and arable land. Correct, yes. So, Ars Technica, amazing write-up on this entire process, because it does tackle the abuse of taxpayer funds. So first off, hold on, quick pause. My neighbors are doing some renovation and we're probably going to hear banging sounds. There's no way for me to block it. I just can't. I do not have the soundproofing or the right kind of mic to eclipse stuff getting dumped in a truck. So I apologize if some of that is making it through on my mic right now. Sorry. Ars Technica is right up here, is an incredible collection of links that walk you through the entire process on how we got to this point and how we're still trying to get these companies to live up to their promises in us giving them hundreds of million taxpayer dollars every year. $6 billion over 10 years, $600 million a year. And they're still, well, it's going to be hard. We need more money. And if you're a conservative, you should be equally outraged. This is standing in the way of your free market arguments that the government is subsidizing and picking winners and losers in this tech space. And they're still running to the government to take more of your hard-earned conservative tax dollars. This is not a left or right issue. This is a rampant abuse of our federal funds management from mega corporations who are only doing this to try and harm competition. So if you're a conservative and you believe in free market competition, you should probably be even more mad than I am. So I'm like, oh, socialism. You should be like, oh, free market. And then we should like do the, I can't do it with by myself, but like, you know, the predator, you know, like, oh, I've got big muscles. Dylan, you son of a gun, you. Whoosh. Sorry, I just maybe rewatched Predator recently and it's a fun movie. The other, John Brodkin, I adore his work on Ars Technica. Yet another program that is probably getting abused. FCC prepares $75 monthly broadband subsidies for, quote, high-cost areas. Federal Communications Commission is paving the way for $75 monthly subsidies to make broadband services more affordable for low-income households in certain high-cost areas. Subsidy will be part of the Affordable Connectivity Program that generally offers $30 monthly discounts to people with low incomes. The ACP was created by Congress in late 2021. We covered it on this podcast. And implemented by the FCC to replace a previous pandemic-related subsidies program. Just like we were talking about on that previous story, the government subsidizing some of these data connections wasn't good enough. These $30 subsidized internet programs, well, that just wasn't enough for the companies to really go after and properly support the most expensive rural and low-income citizens in the United States. You know, again, the people I was just making that whiny voice about, oh, it's so hard to get them internet service and it's so expensive. So there was another program that tried to help improve data connection to Native American reservations, and they were paying $75 subsidies. And the ISPs have lobbied that, well, they need those $75 subsidies for everyone else too. So again, instead of allowing for competition and saying, hey, in this market, we could empower the people in a local community to build like a broadband co-op, that'd be pretty cool. They could all just come together and pay this out. We're talking about communities that are likely struggling to such a degree that they wouldn't be able to do that. And this is where a government program, we talked about it at the peak of the pandemic, that can be a big help. But what do we see happening is a lot of companies saying, yeah, give us these subsidies, give us these funds, and we'll totally hook these people up. And then, oh, but it's kind of hard. We need more money and more subsidies to really do that job. And it really starts to feel like as they make more money hand over fist, as they boast about improved profits every fiscal quarter, as they're talking about layoffs just to kind of help force that line to go up another couple percentage points so shareholders are happy, one of their main grifts is going to the federal government and saying, but we just need more taxpayer dollars. We just need taxpayers to foot even more of this bill. And it all kind of comes right back around because we don't have regulators in place that can really check up on this stuff. We're only just now building the coverage maps. We've talked about this on the podcast a couple of times. We're only just now building those coverage maps to make sure that the people they say they can serve internet access to actually do get internet access. It's maddening. It is incredible. If we weren't inundated by such ridiculous schlock reality TV news coverage of what politics kind of looks like, this is the kind of stuff that we would be marching in the street and getting outraged over, that billions of our taxpayer funds are not going to help the people that we said we could help. I would be livid. I am livid. Dave Burns. Free market. Copycatch, it's always the biggest and richest companies that say things are too expensive. They're pulling out their pockets and little moths are flying up to the sky whenever they talk to Uncle Sam. And as soon as they're done, you know, putting their hand out and getting another fat check from the government, they turn right around and tell their shareholders, boom, we got cash. Let's do a stock buyback. So those were the two FCC stories. Those took longer. I know I always say, I'm going to do this real quick. I never do it real quick. Here's my... Who wants to also maybe clip this and put me on notice? What I'm about to say. The current trend of YouTube is not to make YouTube better and then build much better services for YouTube Premium. The current philosophy for YouTube that I witness is making free YouTube worse and worse and worse so that you'll pay for premium just to make it kind of like how it was before YouTube started making it worse. I believe, it is my assertion, emotional, with no inside information on the operation of YouTube, it is my assertion that YouTube looked at the airline industry and said, hey, we could do that. We could make the process of flying so terrible that people will spend more just to get some of the basics that used to be included in the price of a plane ticket. And now they're applying that kind of business behavior to YouTube. You look at YouTube Premium, YouTube TV, you can keep ratcheting up costs. Because, I mean, where else are you going to watch video? And, you know, we're going to do everything we can to, as an ad company, to start lobbying against technologies that interrupt the serving of advertisements to consumers. That was another story I bumped from this week's show. This week's show was already sort of news heavy. And let's keep an eye out for that. I'm sure that's going to get lobbied pretty hard over the next couple of years. So, YouTube is now rolling out for premium subscribers enhanced 1080p playback for all premium users on the web. Of course, because this is a cynical business move on YouTube's part, who got premium 1080p first? That's right, iPhone and iPad users. Because why enrich your own ecosystem when you can make Apple look better, YouTube? And this is also the big problem that we have with... I mean, it shouldn't be the gamesmanship of we're only going to make Google devices better. It should be we're going to make YouTube better. But where did they do it? They did it first with iPhone users. So you've got these Pixels over here. You've got these Galaxies over there. You've got all these other Android devices. Filthy pores. No. We couldn't wait to like roll it out to everybody at the same time. We had to enrich the experience. And again, put another feather in the cap of Apple to verify their arguments about how iPhones are the premium-est devices. So not only is this, I think, kind of a bad step in a direction we really shouldn't want, but it's also just the hilarity of a team at Google, or excuse me, at Alphabet, because it's not Google anymore, it's Alphabet. One team at Alphabet's like, well, we need to just make more money internally, and so screw all the other teams at Alphabet. We're going to point to our competitor first to roll out this new service. So, you know, it's pretty scummy. You didn't need to clip that whole clip. The main part of the clip that I'm going to point to is, who wants to guess that by this time next year, if you stream something on YouTube at 720p or at 1080p, it's going to look like hot garbage at a ridiculously low, tiny, miserable bitrate, just so that they can try and neg you up to pay for the enhanced 1080p playback. If I had the correct kind of measuring tools for verifying, you know, like the data stream that you get from a website, I would not be surprised if I were to stream 1080p today and then pay for premium a year from now and see the same feed quality. But if you're not paying for premium, all they did was reduce the bitrate for regular 1080p. That's how cynical I've become about these announcements and these moves from YouTube. I do not trust that they're really making the service better. I really feel like they're making their core service worse just to try and squeeze you for a subscription fee to get what you had before. So it's pretty rough. Dave Burns, what was the difference between premium and not premium 1080p? I don't know. So, I mean, like, I showed the link and I didn't actually share the link. I found this one first by way of Engadget from Mariella Moon. They don't have any specific details on this. YouTube started testing 1080p premium earlier this year, describing it as a version of 1080p which provides more information per pixel that results in a higher quality viewing experience. The higher bitrate, which is used as a measurement for the amount of video data transferred within a certain time frame it provides, could give viewers a better quality without having to watch in a higher resolution. So, I don't know. I mean, to me, it kind of makes more sense. Like, you leave 1080p alone, and then maybe you make 4K a premium service or a premium add-on. That would frustrate me, but to me, this is kind of like misrepresenting what quality and resolution and bitrate are supposed to represent. And I could, because again, the vast majority of traffic on YouTube is happening 1080p or lower. So if you want to make 4K and 8K premium add-ons, just like adult video streaming sites do, or any other type of, like Netflix, how there are tiers of pricing where you have to pay more for a higher resolution video stream. I kind of get that. Like, that to me makes more sense. But conflating this low bitrate, high bitrate without real data to tell you what the quality of the streams are, to me that just feels like, nah, you're going to make the free experience even worse than it currently is. Ghost Starscream. Speaking of YouTube Premium, I recently got the email from YouTube saying, thanks for being a customer, therefore we're raising your monthly subscription costs. Yeah. See, that's another one. Kind of circling back to my point at the top of this podcast, I can't front that as the solution. Well, just don't watch or pay for premium if you don't want to watch ads. That's not why I started making videos, and that's not why I tried to build a community on YouTube. That's not what I think is best for people. So, again, I'm going to keep telling people about, like, instead of using YouTube's recommendation engine, set up a feed reader. If you followed a YouTube content creator and you aren't getting notifications on their new videos, you can fix that. There's an RSS feed for their videos, and you put it into a feed reader, and you will get the exact alert when they put out a video. And you don't have to guess, are they still making stuff? I didn't even know Juan was still making videos. You have the power. As long as you keep validating YouTube's business model here, YouTube is going to continuously get worse. Cory Doctorow has a really novel word for this that in a PG podcast here, I'm not going to repeat, but it's easy to find. And now it's YouTube is squeezing both their content creators and their advertisers. making the experience for both of the mechanisms that fuel YouTube worse and worse and worse to enrich their own financial commitments to their shareholders and their investors. And it's pretty gross. And we should be upset about it. Again, maybe not marching in the streets upset because it's just YouTube, but still really, really upset. Yeah, I'm way behind on comments, and I just realized we're full on into the first hour here. I do want to mention this one here because this is a buyer beware kind of a story. This is the third, I believe this is the last link I've got from Ars Technica here, and it's not John Brodkin. So there, booyah. Written up by Sharon Harding. Real quick, this is a buyer beware. Cheap laptops are kind of a sketchy investment for a lot of consumers. Looks like a great deal. You get kind of a student grade, almost disposable sort of piece of e-waste. It's likely less powerful than a 2 or 3 year old premium smartphone. Really, really not great. But there's a reason why Chromebooks can kind of flood a market, and why we saw Chromebook sales rise during the pandemic was because they were inexpensive ways just to get a functional web services machine into a household at a time where prices were skyrocketing on components, especially like, you know, graphics cards and things like that. So for your family and friends, get them to talk to you before they make tech purchases. I have this problem with my family where they like to buy something and then ask me to fix it. And instead, if they just talk to me first, they'd probably save themselves a lot of headaches. This story written up by Sharon Harding, absurd, Google, Amazon rebuked over unsupported Chromebooks still for sale. And they show a list of these Chromebooks. Now, on a Chromebook, you're only guaranteed a certain number of years of software support. And it is actually built into the Chrome OS settings page. You can go to your Chrome settings and you can see this machine was produced at this time. You get this many years of software support, and when that expires, you don't get updates anymore. That machine is basically cut off. It used to be really punitive. It used to be very, very minimal. You'd get like 4 years. Now there are a few Chromebook manufacturers like Acer and I think Lenovo. They've got a list here. I don't know why I'm trying to guess. This is from the Ars Technica article. The Chromebook 14 for work from Acer gets 7 years of software support. Asus has a Chromebook that got 6 years of support. Dell, 6 years. HP, 7 years. The Samsung Chromebook Pro, 5 years, but their Chromebook Plus got 6 years. And Lenovo, it looks like, is actually kind of the bottom. I had that mistake, and I thought Lenovo was one of the companies giving more software support. Now that I say that out loud, that's kind of silly. Lenovo is never the company that gives more years of software support. So this is bad for consumers. We can be the ambassadors for our family and friends and say, hey, are you looking for just a simple web browsing internet portal machine? Chromebook can be great. Let's find you one that was put out recently. Because even if the machine is still available to buy, that doesn't mean you start your 7 years when you buy it. You start your 7 years from the first time one of those machines was manufactured. So if this machine was built in 2019, if that model was originally constructed in 2019, the clock has been ticking since 2019. So you'll buy it and you might already be out of support. And some of these machines are still kind of premium priced devices. One of them... So from this article, Sharon writes up, but right now you can buy a new unused Flip C302 for $550 from Amazon. It is already out of support. So that's $550 on a Chromebook. That's kind of premium priced for a Chromebook. You're starting to climb into the upper mid-range of what a Chromebook can cost. And you're already done. That machine is already done. So while we can be those ambassadors for our family and friends, what's really going to hurt, we boosted education for a couple years, that's where we saw some of the biggest surge in Chromebook sales. And Chromebooks became some of the highest selling laptops on digital marketplaces. Well, those Chromebooks are going to start falling out of support. And now we're going to have mountains of these laptop shells. You can't really easily keep them up to spec. And what I'm hoping is educators will take this as an opportunity to look at their IT commitments and then also look at other strategies and other solutions, like, well, maybe we start teaching kids basic computing on Linux machines. And we take all these Chromebooks and we start trying to find ways to flash them over to another operating system that will get continued support for longer periods of time. Given how we value education in this country, I don't believe many school districts will be empowered to facilitate that kind of tech relationship. Instead, they're going to have to just burn more money and buy more cheap disposable laptops that won't get any better support. And every couple of years, we're going to see a school district struggle to replace machines that are still perfectly functional compute devices. Look at what we've done in the mid-range of tablets and smartphones and Chromebooks. We've been in this little circular window of compute power for about 4 years now. I would say since the Snapdragon 855, we keep selling the same tier of compute power over and over and over again. The machines haven't really gotten more powerful. Prices have dropped, so you can get that tier of performance for a little bit less. But then we have to do something like put an artificial software deadlock on the machine that's still perfectly capable of doing this kind of student-grade compute work. Well, it's out of support. You don't get any new software. You just got to buy a new one. And what are they going to do? They're going to buy a new one at the same compute power tier. They're going to be rebuying basically the same machine just to get back on the train of software updates. From Baseball Super, without the software, without the updates, the Chromebooks still work, though, for school. So once you're cut off, you don't get any new Chrome OS updates. That is likely going to fall afoul of most schools' IT commitments. Bug fixes, security patches, those are the things that keep sort of a product somewhat viable in that community, because it's not the IT department having to facilitate all of these different workarounds or patches, or if there's a security exploit, they're getting that support directly from the manufacturer. And once they're cut off, there's not really anything you can do there. So if there's a massive zero day that goes out for Chromebooks, they are going to be held liable for all of the personal data of the school, the administration, and of the individual students. Now, for consumers, that's bad enough. But when we start talking about kids, that's when people get real lit up. So even though we're not funding these IT departments, we're not funding the schools to really take technology and really incorporate it into these lessons plans, we're kind of like halfway measuring, maybe it's a tablet, maybe it's an iPad, maybe it's a Chromebook. I don't know, kids do computer stuff. Even though we're not really doing that well and we're not funding it the way we should, we still hold them to the same standards as like mega corporations. The IT department at the school put out Chromebooks that were dangerous for our kids to use and had bugs and security holes in them. And now the parents are going to sue the school district. That is a part of their commitment and their obligation and their responsibility, so they should be doing it better. But as they're trying to find cost-effective ways to bring technology into students' hands, we're still dealing with an ecosystem of products that are still sitting on store shelves that you can buy today that are already obsolete. And they're not obsolete because of the hardware. They can still, like you're saying, Baseball Super, you're correct. You can still do compute work on an expired Chromebook. But you can't live up to your obligations and your commitment to protect user data, privacy, keep people free from online harm if you're not getting security patches and bug fixes and updates. And again, I just feel like this is another opportunity to say consumers who have a decently powerful smartphone have more compute power in their pocket than many of these Chromebooks. And that's sad. Switching gears, but not really. I'm going to drink some more coffee.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
I started Tech Potato with a vision. I'd already been covering processors and technology for 10 years as senior editor for Anantech, but only through the written word. With today's media so diverse, I chose to one-up my vision and move to video and explain the nuance of complex topics. Hi, my name's Ian Cutress, and I'm Chief Spud at Tech Potato. The goal at Tech Potato is to have fun, to talk about areas of the technology industry that aren't always covered. Sometimes there are non-obvious aspects to a topic which doesn't always come across in written media, and that's where I strike. The channel is also there to shine a light into the areas that most end users don't even know exist. There's also a tongue-in-cheek joke. Processors are called chips, and just like a bag of chips, I like to get my teeth into these things, hence Tech Potato. The thumbnails are stupid, but the content is real. If you're interested about how things in this technology industry work, or for reports on behind-the-scenes events, plus some classic British humor, then head on over. You'll be welcome with open arms.
Leading semiconductor industry players join forces to accelerate RISC-V. Uh-oh, things are getting spicy. After Arm sued Qualcomm, Qualcomm is putting out a press release that working with, I don't know how you say this, Bosch? I think that's how you say Bosch. NXP, Infineon, and Nordic Semiconductor are all working together. They're forming a little conglomerate to look at boosting RISC-V. And so they're going to be starting first with automotive products and some IoT designs before really trying to push more into mobile. But this is a pretty broad shot across the bow of ARM, where Qualcomm and ARM have been in kind of some legal tussles and some contentious relationships. So the chips that go into like your phone, your tablet, I have my Robo Incala that has a Qualcomm ARM chip. ARM creates these designs with these kinds of CPU cores, and they have different tiers of licensing. So you can license just the ARM tech, or you can get a license to build on the ARM tech or do your own custom versions of ARM tech. ARM chips have kind of taken over the mobile and the sort of the pocket compute environment, smartphones, tablets, etc. And it's loosely the tech that makes Apple gear so compelling. So the M series processors are licensed ARM designs. RISC-V is an open source. I'm doing a terrible job of explaining this. RISC-V is an open source platform, so that you can build chips on a different kind of manufacturing process. But this is interesting to see Qualcomm partner with a bunch of big players in this space, because that would be a direct competitor against some of the applications that ARM is being used in. And especially when we start talking about things like IoT and automotive, that also kind of chips away at some of the other manufacturers that have been putting out chips for cars and chips for smart thermostats and things like that. And so if Qualcomm can gather a little bit of momentum on this, that's a huge fork in what other companies will be able to compete with. Because right now, like for example, Qualcomm and MediaTek, you probably have numerous devices in your home that are using these little low power ARM SoCs, systems on chips. Like a TV has a little chip in it, probably made by MediaTek, but it's based on an ARM reference. But if Qualcomm can come in and say, hey, we can make a similar chip and it's going to be, you know, this expensive, and we can work with these partners and we can make it cost effective and it delivers a similar kind of performance, you just have to work on this kind of software, then that could be a compelling competition, which will force a price war between ARM components and RISC components. We already know that there's a team at Google that is already working on doing things like
making Android run better on RISC hardware. So this is just a really... I thought this one was kind of quiet, the way that it was put out there as a press release from Qualcomm, but it's actually got some really deep ramifications for, I would say, about 3 to 5 years from now. Could be a really big separation in sort of the tech industry. And I think it's really clever to go after the daily driver mini tech things. You get a smart speaker, you could go RISC. And it's okay if there are a couple little things that are different, or maybe if that chip isn't quite as efficient, but it was cheaper to produce than a comparable ARM chip. I mean, like, you can kind of get away with a little bit more in like a smart display or a thermostat or a webcam or something like that, and then build up to using RISC for more data intensive applications. So it could be pretty great. I'm very interested in what Qualcomm can do, actually putting some effort behind this, because we know that they've been facing these legal challenges trying to compete directly against Apple. And they they acquired another company that was making these CPU cores. And this is sort of the next, like, laptop chip that Qualcomm wants to put out was in the crosshairs. ARM put that in the crosshairs and made it a very staunch legal challenge against the licensing that Qualcomm paid for versus this other company that they acquired. And you can kind of feel like, if ARM is going to sue one of their biggest production partners, everybody in the industry kind of went, oh, we could be next. if we want to do something that diverts and we didn't have exactly the right license, or if not even if they did, if ARM can argue that they didn't have the right license to do that, again, Apple is going to have free reign to kind of keep building on their own momentum there. And ARM is not going to fight Apple on whatever licensing that they choose for the M series processors or the A series processors. But Qualcomm, okay, they went after Qualcomm. And now we're seeing development on RISC. Boy, that's pretty good. Yeah, Bosch makes appliances too. This is a biggie. And again, if Bosch, Infineon, Nordic, NXP, if these companies are saying, hey, we have market solutions ready for this type of processor, that's going to be a lot of money really fast. All right, we still haven't even made it to the sciencey stuff yet. Boy, I've been talking for an hour 15. Okay, I'm going to flip the order on these real quick. Be pretty cool if we could figure out nuclear fusion, right? As another power generating alternative. We've been seeing like these murmurings of like advancements in exotic materials and in different kind of reactors and different kinds of chambers. And it's always been sort of elusive to generate more power in a controlled setting than what it takes to fuel a fusion reaction. But scientists at Lawrence Livermore, and I'm sort of excited about this because when I was doing contracting work for the Department of Energy, my beat was Sandia Labs and Los Alamos Labs in New Mexico. But we had a division at the time that also did work with Lawrence Livermore. And Lawrence Livermore recently generated more energy in a fusion reaction than they put into generating the fusion reaction. So we had net energy over the lasers used to fire off this reaction. That was really exciting, but it's just a little baby step. Can we verify that? Well, wouldn't you know it, recently, U.S. scientists repeat fusion ignition breakthrough for the second time at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. back in December, they did the first one, and now they have done it again. That experiment briefly achieved what's known as fusion ignition by generating 3.15 megajoules of energy output after the laser delivered 2.05 megajoules to the target. Now, I'm no math genius, but getting 3 megajoules of energy out of expending 2 megajoules of energy seems like that's a pretty decent improvement over how much energy it took to create the reaction. And they have now replicated that experiment. They've done it again. And this is another little baby step in the chain of apathy that we've had towards properly utilizing fusion for real energy generation, for real consumer and citizen purposes. I am silly excited to see that, like, because it wasn't just like, oh, well, you know, we created a fusion reaction. We've been able to do that for a really long time. We can fuse these elements. It produces a ton of energy. We can make bombs that could obliterate every human on the planet. But to control this and to harness it, and now to take our little second baby step towards saying, no, we can create more energy than we expended. That also means we've seen incredible breakthroughs in things like building lasers. The system that now does this is highly energy efficient lasers bombarding this material or this fuel with concentrated energy. And before, like, what it would take, the amount of energy it would take to create a fusion reaction was an order of magnitude higher than the amount of energy that you would receive. But it was cool. We could make that fusion reaction happen. And now we have worked on the efficiency of all of these other systems in a way where we've not only reached parity, we've been at parity for a while too. Now the energy we generate is displacing the energy consumed. That is amazing. And hopefully in my lifetime, we'll actually see fusion harnessed as a viable energy, sustainable resource. You know, as we face crazy climate change and population displacement and temperatures higher than ever before and polar ice caps melting, now is a good time. I mean, the best time to have achieved some of these improvements would have been like 30 years ago, but the second best time is today. So we should continue to get on that. That would be very, very nice. Muppinish, it's 20 years away anyway. Fusion has always been like 30 years away for the last, what, you know, 50 years, 60 years that we've been studying fusion. If we had funded it the way that we're now actually starting to put more money back into fusion research, we would have been doing better over these last 40 or 50 years. Dave Burns, but is fusion energy profitable enough, Juan? What about the profits? Won't someone please think of the shareholders? How will they own more yachts if we can't monetize fusion and we make it more expensive for poor people so rich people can stay rich? Oh, no! Muppinish, I know. I'm getting real anxious. A sustainable, repeatable reaction is the next step. And that's where some of these other... That's where some of these other material science conversations get really interesting too, is like, okay, we can make this incredibly hot thing happen. Now, can we make this incredibly hot thing happen a bunch of times without destroying the container that that incredibly hot thing happens? I am so grossly oversimplifying the incredible science and the tremendous challenges by going like, oh, but it's like a big hot thing. I would even refer you back to, like, Spider-Man 2, the power of the sun in the palm of my hand. Because the other big story that exploded over this last week that I have struggled to wrap my brain around, and I'm really hoping that people in the chat are going to fill in some of the gaps, because, like I said, when it comes to things like engineering and physics, I'm pretty good with optics, and I'm really good with acoustics. Like, I've actually studied this stuff. I've got textbooks all around my office and downstairs. I know my way around wavelengths and, you know, frequency and response, and from a consumer standpoint, but also just the physics of it, I think are really interesting. How do we generate sound? How does our biology interact with energy flying through the air? You tell me a story about a superconductor, And that to me just sounds like science fiction magic. And this whole last week, DT and Nils beaten me to the punch. Are we going to talk about room temperature superconductors? We're going to try. I am not qualified to be the messenger. Okay, how about this? I am qualified to be the messenger on a link that can then better explain some of what this science is. But this whole last week, I have been rabidly consuming any article I could find about a material that came out of Korea, came out of South Korea, called LK99. And it has sparked a race of material science engineers trying to replicate some of the early disclosed results of an experiment about a material that could be a room temperature superconductor. A superconductor is a material that has no resistance, no electrical resistance. How do I know anything about electrical resistance? Is I'm a headphone nerd. And if you have an LG phone, you have a phone that detects the resistance of your audio equipment and properly points its amp to deliver the correct amount of power to the headphones or speakers that you connect to that phone. So I have the best phone ever made. This is the LG V60, going down in history as one of the greatest of all time. And it's got this really handy-dandy little headphone jack. And you can plug some cabled headphones. These are my Ecos, so they don't require a lot of juice. This headphone jack detects the resistance of this cable, says, oh, you don't need a lot of power. The amp manages that for you, and you get the appropriate power to the driver on these earbuds. You have an amazing listening experience. A superconductor has no resistance. And if you can imagine the thought experiment, this is kind of the way I wrapped my brain around it. It is absolutely not scientifically accurate. I am grossly oversimplifying something that helped my brain sort of wrap around some of the physics of this. If you could imagine putting electricity into a zero resistance cable, and before the electricity exited the other side of the cable, you could close that cable off with zero resistance, you would never see a degradation in the energy in that cabling system. That's not accurate. That's probably more confusing than anything else. I'm just expressing the trolley car exercise in my brain that helped me start kind of grokking what superconductors could be. And they also exhibit these really interesting magnetic rejection properties. But the problem with a lot of the superconductors that we use is they have to be chilled to a ridiculously low temperature. So, like regular conducting material, as you make it colder, there's like a, not a linear, but there's a gradual reduction in resistance. They get less resistive as they get colder. They get less resistant as they get colder. But a superconductor, as it reaches a certain low temperature, suddenly drops to zero resistance. It's a type of material that we understand it, we've been studying it, we can do all these cool things with it, but that takes a lot of energy, super cooling this material. So it's the dream of a lot of these material scientists to say, well, if we could have a superconducting material that operates at closer to room temperature, that would free up a lot of these energy concerns, and we could use that material in a number of other applications with, you know, better reliability, better stability, less energy, and less power draw. That could be really exciting. So muppinish, things like X-ray machines and MRI equipment for poor people. If you have an MRI, one of the applications of a superconducting material is you can do this really cool brain scanning. Well, you can't easily cart an MRI out into the field and scan for health anomalies in people that are in poor, rural, or displaced communities. But if we had room temperature or slightly above room temperature superconducting materials, we would be able to make this machinery more portable, less power intensive. We could radicalize you know, the medical industry with a number of these advancements. It is again, it sounds like magical science fiction. Reading up on the Meissner effect, where a material suddenly becomes super cooled and it rejects a magnetic field, and you can do all kinds of interesting things with that. So a science firm out of South Korea published a paper saying, hey, through this really exotic baking process, we've found a material that exhibits some of the properties that we would see in a room temperature semiconductor, and it's called LK99. And again, as another grossly oversimplified, probably to the point of inaccurate kind of description, their process for making this sounds like you pour all of these materials into an oven and you bake a chocolate chip cookie. And then in that chocolate chip cookie, there you're trying to pick out the chocolate chips of varying quality. Some have more cacao, some have less. And you can find some of these individual chips exhibit this property of superconducting at room temperature. And so they published their recipe for this cookie, only they kind of did what my aunt would do with some of her favorite Italian recipes, where maybe she didn't give you all the ingredients, or maybe she left out a step that really makes her antipasta like to die for. Maybe she left out some of the seasonings that really get her mushroom soup that beautiful, rich, consistent umami flavor. It's feeling a little like by not properly locking every single kind of like tiny step of the process that they used to arrive at making LK99, but we've already seen a number of labs around the world trying to replicate this baking process to see if they can also confirm or refute the findings from this firm. And it's also sparked, because again, it's high energy. It's a hot furnace you need to like build all this stuff. But we've also seen like just some hobbyists getting into this too, because there's nothing so exotic about the list of materials that someone with like a kiln in their own backyard wouldn't be able to try and replicate this experiment. As far as I've read to this point today, literally this morning, another organization has come out and said, hey, we tried to replicate this process. We don't know if we've exactly achieved the material that these researchers have made, because again, some of the recipe is a little unclear how you're supposed to make this stuff. But what we found is a material that actually exhibits some really interesting diamagnetic properties, but we don't believe it's a superconductor. So even if this doesn't turn out to be the revolutionary room temperature superconducting material that the first firm has promised it is, it could still be an interesting new step in material science for just better magnets. You can make a better diamagnet. You actually have a number of interesting mechanical applications. It's not exotic. It's not going to revolutionize, medical science or transportation, or also the superconductors that we would use in something like quantum computing. You could do a room temperature superconductor that would actually bring down a lot of the energy costs for advancing the next generation of quantum supercomputers. But a new diamagnet would actually be really cool tech too. So I'm linking to an article from Nature. This is a couple days old now, so it doesn't include the most recent sort of findings that have been sort of shared online. But I think this is a very good summation of what LK99 is, what it's claimed to be. I'm sorry. This is a very good article explaining what LK99 is claimed to be, and then the troubles that we've seen in replicating or confirming the scientific claims made by these South Korean researchers. So this is written up by Dan Garisto at nature.com, and I'll have that linked in the show notes this week. This to me is like, in my lifetime, I did not believe that we would see stuff like practical fusion or a room temperature superconductor. Those are the kind of magical stumbling blocks to some of the Star Trek technology that we see in science fiction, right? This doesn't mean we immediately get warp drive, But in science fiction, we always have like magic. And in that magic, there's all of this science to say, yes, this would absolutely be possible except for this one impossible thing. Right? We could totally travel faster than the speed of light if we can warp the fabric of space. And all we need is unlimited power to do it. You're like, okay, I followed you. Yes, warp drive, totally, totally feasible. Totally possible. Time travel, absolutely. We can do it. Except for that one impossible thing. These types of scientific discoveries and this type of application of practical engineering and like material science and all of these different disciplines coming together, that's the stuff that got me freaking out about Star Trek as a kid, is how much of... I would watch reruns of the original series with my dad, and it's Kirk and Spock, and they're flying through space as if space isn't hard to travel through. That was never the plot of a Star Trek episode, is space is scary. They lived in a future where the technology had created sort of a capsule that made space travel kind of mundane, and they would go on these adventures. And I grew up in a family, you know, my dad is, you know, a PhD in engineering, and my mom is a computer scientist, and like the math is just as much a part of the storytelling as the drama. And so we would watch, you know, Kirk double fist a Gorn on the back of the head, but then at the same time, like, the properties of a phaser had some grounding in actual science. And my dad would tell stories about like some of the stuff he was working on in labs in the Air Force. My mom would talk about like her experiences working for telecommunications companies and programming software for people. And you're like, that just made Star Trek feel so much more grounded, so much more real. I remember when we switched from 5 1/4 floppies, those floppy Waka 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 floppy disks, and we got a 3.5. And those looked just like the isolinear cards in Star Trek. And like, holy cow, we beat Star Trek. Star Trek is supposed to be hundreds of years in the future, and here I'm holding a hard piece of plastic that has data on it, and it's storing a ridiculous amount of information. It's storing 1.4 megabytes of information, and it's so much smaller than the floppy that we used to use, and it's more durable, and it's got a guard, and it protects. It's so much better evolved over what we had, and I just slot it into my computer, and it works just like it does on Star Trek. We keep beating Star Trek, and that lights me up so much. It's like the last little hope I have for humanity is, can I look at something that happened in Star Trek The Next Generation and point to things like, no, we got better stuff than they had. Think about those little pads that they used to use, like the little mini tablets would have all those weird, like funky interfaces. And you're like, nah, actually, you know what? Just weird little glowing orange curved rectangles. Not a great interface. I actually prefer Windows 11. Over Elcars, you know, like my Robo and Kala, way better than anything Picard ever used on Next Gen. And it, like, we keep building on this stuff. When we hit some kind of new magnetic material, superconducting material, something that, you know, gets you interested enough that you want to go and look up a Wikipedia article on the Meissner effect just so that you can kind of wrap your brain around what it is that they're talking about. And then you think, that could be the future of magnetic levitation. We could make high-speed rail an order of magnitude less expensive using these types of materials if they're not that exotic. Well, think about all of the people that just got helped by that. Think about all of the infrastructure that just improved by that. And then again, fusion, taking another baby step towards being a viable, replicatable process. I genuinely did not believe we would be talking about this kind of stuff in my lifetime. I'm actually like kind of worked up and a little emotional that we're talking about this kind of stuff in my lifetime. I have so much Star Trek FOMO. I want to see the future. I want to see what those technologies look like. I want to see how far humanity can progress. I am constantly cursing my mortal form that I won't get to see like the evolution of our species, even if we destroy ourselves. I want to know what that looks like, and I'll never get to see it. But little glimmers of this mean that we have a potential for our species to exist beyond just like the life cycle of me and my relatives and my kids. It's heady stuff, but if you got into the classic science fiction, if you got into the Asimov and the Bradbury and the Arthur C. Clarke, it's glorious to feel this as a presence bigger than just our unique moment in time, and it's something to celebrate. So even if LK99 turns out to be a more mundane material than was originally promised to be, it's still an exciting application of the entire scientific community working on a problem. And even if it turns out that it's not what it what they promised it to be, it still demonstrates that the scientific community has that heart and has that spirit to jump onto something that could be potentially exciting, and we'll learn more about what built up to this material discovery and will still come out the other side better and smarter for having gone down this kind of hype train on a new material. We're still going to come out the other side of this with at least a material understanding of something that could still be a better material for magnetism than we're currently using. Even that is an exciting step towards the future of our collective intelligence. I'm going to take a drink of coffee. And for the last 20 minutes, we want to talk about anything else. I'm going to let the chat kind of lead us through all this. I'll just keep babbling. About stuff that I don't really fully understand. Old Trev, Michael Fisher would disagree about LCARS. I'm sorry, LCARS is a stupid interface. It really is. I am piloting a humongous vessel. A galaxy-class starship. It needs to be resistant to any type of encounter in space, where space is incredibly hostile. And if there's like a minor power interruption, my touchscreen will go dark. Also, in controlling this galaxy-class starship that could end a civilization. It has the capabilities and the power to destroy all life on a planet. It is a smooth, featureless, tactileless display. Like, it doesn't even work for us driving an automobile, but let's say you're in some kind of space turbulence or you're receiving, you know, repulsor fire from some kind of Romulan threat, and your finger slips just a little, and the computer is going to do something different. Oh, target this ship. Oh no! What did my hands just touch? I don't know, because it's a smooth piece of glass, and all of the little rounded rectangles of the LCARS interface are only delineated by very minor changes in color. That is the stupidest way to pilot such a powerful vessel. The TARDIS on Doctor Who makes more sense for a mechanical interface to control a flying spaceship, where you're supposed to have six people standing around in a circle moving giant levers and turning dials. That actually, I think, is a more practical spacefaring interface than LCARS on Star Trek The Next Generation. I adore Star Trek. I think the dumbest thing Star Trek has ever done is try to anticipate what consumer technology was going to look like 5 years in the future, and then act like that was going to be the future for like space travel 300 years in the future. I just don't buy it. And especially, like, we've had other examples, I think, of very, very clever storytelling in Battlestar Galactica and in The Expanse, where I think the depiction and the reality of the enormity of space are better represented than anything Star Trek has done. I think The Expanse is a really beautiful, scientifically grounded look at, like, how challenging it is just to navigate our solar system. And even with these, you know, futuristic rockets, it still takes us a long time to travel the solar system. Like, for example, one of the things that I've always thought is kind of silly magic in Star Trek is the inertia dampening field. So the giant dish on the front of a starship in Star Trek is responsible for canceling inertia for all of the people inside the ship, but does not impede the forward inertia of the spaceship. That's impossible. You know, like I said, you know, warp travel, you can do all this cool stuff except for these impossible things. That's not a thing. It's not like I can put like a wave machine on the front of my car to stop me from getting pulled back into my seat when I accelerate my car. That doesn't exist. That kind of breaks physics. So it's that kind of stuff. You know, like, you've made space travel so safe and so boring and so mundane that the drama of Star Trek comes from interpersonal relationships and galactic political conflict, and that's the drama. It's about soapboxing current day politics in a futuristic setting. That's all Star Trek should ever be. Is soapboxing about like racism and political discourse and war, and that's where Star Trek is at its best. But if you look at the science of Star Trek, even though it is grounded in some heavily researched scientific study, you always get to this magic. The reality of a transporter in Star Trek is kind of terrifying. You're taken apart at a molecular level, and your blueprint is then sent to a machine that just has kind of a bucket of material. And then it reconstructs you at a molecular level. So you are a copy of your original self every time you go through a transporter. There's not a direct, you know, I've sent you from the ship down to the planet. They didn't send your material down to the planet. There's a transporter buffer, and then they kind of have unlimited energy to turn into matter. That's how you can have something like a holodeck, but it's also the sort of horrific idea of, at some point, you are disassembled and your consciousness is severed, and then that information is beamed to another place, and then you're sort of reassembled in this little, like, energy-shielded beam. Is freaky. The philosophical ramifications of something like the transporter are some of the most delicious things to, like, get drunk one night, responsibly, of course, and then debate consciousness with someone that you care about. Because you just take it for granted in Star Trek land. It's not dangerous. People are comfortable with it. I think we've seen like two transporter malfunctions that caused mortalities in all of Star Trek, one of them in Star Trek the Motion Picture. Like, that's not a big deal for them. And they have to only occasionally debate the philosophy of that when the writers do something clever, like they clone Riker with the transporter beam bounced off of something and then it created an alternate Riker. But where was the energy and the material to make another Riker? Oh, you know, reflections, energy, something. I don't know. There's two Rikers now. It's just fun. Jonathan Frakes is a really fun actor. So we just wanted to see him like act against himself.
The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by One More. Treat your ears. One More's mission is to bring innovation, design, and quality to all music lovers, young or old, frugal or spendy. Offering an incredible collection of earbuds at all tiers of the market, cabled or Bluetooth, neckband or true wireless. Fantastic sound quality, top-tier tuning, excellent noise reduction. I've personally been a fan for a couple years now. There's a whole collection of great audio options for you to shop at affordable prices. And for listeners of this podcast, I can also do you one better. If you shop at onemore.com, use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY10 at checkout. Once again, SOMEGADGETGUY10 with no spaces. You'll save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. You'd spend over $80 less on One More's dual driver ANC True Wireless compared to that other brand's Pro earbuds. You know who I'm talking about. One More brings style, premium audio quality, and cool tech features to the table at prices that won't hurt the wallet. You can check out these multiple award-winning audio solutions at onemore.com. And remember to use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY10 at checkout to save some scratch. Now, let's get on with the show.
Yes, Gormlord. We'd see them jump to warp once and then turn to pulp, then cut to credits. That's what I love about The Expanse, is like the rocket power is very practical. It's kind of grounded in that physics. And the design of the ships is such where the forward momentum points the people sitting in the ship in a way that you wouldn't traditionally design for a lot of science fiction stories. But like, they have to do things like, you sit in this chair, and if you go too fast, your body gets crushed. And it's very much like the Top Gun movie. I think they did a really good job in Top Gun of showing like, hey, you've got to do this steep dive and then fight the effects of gravity coming up, and you're going to hit like 9 times gravity. We can say that, oh, they pulled 9 G's in that scoop up. Well, if you weigh 100 pounds, again, just go, I'm keeping the number simple here. If you weigh 100 pounds and then you hit a 9G rise, you will feel like you weigh 900 pounds because it's 9 times the effect of gravity that you're accelerating, that you're moving through air at such velocity that you're working against all of those forces. And I feel like it's the same thing. If you have an impulse engine in Star Trek, which I think travels at like half the speed of light, but when you see it in Star Trek, they just go. So it's like sudden acceleration. Everyone on that ship should be whoosh, against the nearest wall and just splattered all over that wall. I love it. I love it because it's so silly. It's such magic. But like, that's what we have to overcome to really tell the story they want to tell. Is you just have to kind of like set that aside and be like, okay, well, yeah, that's fantasy. But the science fiction is this conflict. So I love it. DTNL, my phone does 5G, Juan. 9G doesn't seem like much. It's not even twice as much, right? It's like 5G plus 4. Copa Cash, they did it. They did it. Spaceballs better. Didn't they do that? Wasn't that one of the jokes in Spaceballs? They accelerate and you see like someone smashed against the back of the wall. It's stuff like that I love about our storytelling. So this week got real wacky for the science news. I was a kid in a candy store. This whole announcement, everything that was going down, and at the same time, I've been playing with these amazingly fun consumer tech products, and it really has been highlighting like there are all these new experiences and all these people that are completely unfamiliar, and I feel like the pressure is still building. Like I put glasses on someone's face and it clicks and something shifts in their brain. My daughter had a little play date with a friend from her school, and I took out a product that I am hopefully going to be showing off this week, and I saw her teach another 7-year-old how to use kind of an advanced little tech gadget. And the company was making all of these claims like this is the easiest thing to do and like everybody can now do this. It used to be something a lot more complicated, and it's hard to judge for myself because like I live this stuff. But then I saw a 7-year-old teach another 7-year-old how to use it, and you're like, okay, you know what, that was a claim of substance that we can move this experience and make it more accessible for people that are not familiar with this kind of gear. I've been playing with other machinery that's getting my daughter interested in design software. Like she wants to build things, and you're like, okay, you can actually figure this stuff. You don't have to just go to the toy aisle at Target and hope they have the thing that you want. We can actually go and we can actually check things out, and then you can see like, I want to make something, and then we can make it. And that's really empowering. And it kind of lights up this other gear in my daughter where she's already kind of a geek anyway, but like, oh, I can really do this. I can really make this. I can really use these things. Oh, Tech Potato, Dr. Ian. Did y'all talk about LK99 yet? Okay, so I have poorly regurgitated some of the condensed articles on what LK99 represents, and I am almost positive I have misrepresented a lot of the science, a lot of the material science on what the challenge is and what this experience has been like. If you're making a video on LK99, please let me know, and I will do my darndest to help share it as far and as wide around the web, because I feel like you're someone who would have a very interesting take on the application of a room temperature superconductor and whether or not this science actually makes sense given the properties that have been described and the testing that other researchers have conducted. But everyone should be subscribed to Tech Tech Potato regardless, because Dr. Ian has been doing some phenomenal commentary on the sort of the high end of like servers and data centers and the compute power that we're really starting to achieve at kind of a global scale. So thanks for dropping by, though. I really appreciate it. You would have gotten a big chuckle out of me nerding out on this stuff and not really being able to fully articulate why I've been so interested in it. Okay, this is it. This is exactly what I wanted to hear from someone who knows more than me, because my feeling was, and Dr. Ian is delightfully correcting me on this, but my feeling was, my feels, not my rationals, my feels was, even if LK99 turns out to not be what they asserted it was, it would still lead in a boon to other material sciences and manufacturing. So Dr. Ian has left this comment here on the chat. Even if it amounts to nothing, the research into copper-doped lead apatites should lead to a new field of superconductor research, especially if replaced with gold or silver. And my feeling was, like, even if this just turns out to be kind of a different way to build a diamagnet, that in and of itself is knowledge that would lead to other advances in material science. So I feel like that was a more learned response than me just going, well, it could be cool. Thank you so much for leaving that comment. You can't tell how tickled I am to have that dropped in the live chat just from someone who really does know this stuff more than I do. All right. We still have like 10 minutes here. If you guys want to ask some questions, Onscon has a great one. Here, let me pull this up. Question, are the USB-C ports on the Robo and Kala laptop in the same places as the Surface Pro 9? I see these docks that plug into both ports on the Surface, and I would like one for the R&K. So I have the Robo and Kala here. I no longer have the Surface Pro 9, so I can't show this off as directly, but they're not exact because the tablets are different aspect ratios. Literally the size and shape of the tablet and the screen means if a dock is built specifically for the Surface Pro 9, going to this 16:10 aspect ratio means that your USB-C ports are not going to line up in exactly the same way. But they are reasonably close. So if it's something like you've got a cable that goes down to a desktop dock, that should work great. But if it's something where it's like it's paired to clip directly to the side of the Surface and it interacts with the Surface in a more seamless way, probably not going to work. Probably not going to work here compared to the accessories that might work on a Surface Pro 9. So for me, what's been really fun is I have a desktop hub that's down there, and then I have a couple different laptop hubs. One of my laptop hubs is that Eco. So it's got like a really high-end DAC built into the hub, and it's just long enough on the cable to kind of sort of sit side by side with the Robo and Kala. It's a little bit lifted even off of the bottom USB-C port, but then I've got extra USB ports, I've got a display out, and I've got a really high quality audio out on that laptop hub. So that's kind of what I've been pairing with my Robo and Kala. I really like using accessories that live beyond one device. So I've been using the same laptop hub for, when did I start doing that? I think with the LG V20 is when I started plugging laptop hubs into Android phones. And I've had the same laptop hub and the same Ethernet adapter, I think since the V20. So I don't know how many years ago, it was 4 or 7 years. And then I got the Eco, and then I got, what is this other one? The Easy Quest. Actually, I've got a boxed version down here because I got one from Marie. Hold on, let me just drop over here. So I did articles I did articles on both of these, but the Easy Quests have been pretty good. And they're like 30 or 40 bucks, lots of extra little ports and stuff. The cables just aren't quite long enough to lay flat next to a Surface Pro or this Robo Ancala. But HDMI output, this one, blah, 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 blah. HDMI output, gigabit Ethernet, USB-C output. And that's the exciting thing is for a lot of these laptop hubs is that we're starting to get additional USB-C ports. The older USB-C hubs would only give us USB-A ports. So this is so silly because we're talking about like a thing that gives you a couple extra ports for your laptop. But like we're actually seeing some fun advancement. Like those accessories are also improving and getting better too. They're just not the sexy things that, you know, like AR glasses for your face. Oh, Dr. Ian, rocking my socks here. I have to give the no sound proper announcement that Dr. Ian is subscribed with Prime, supporting this podcast. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Subscribed for 7 months. He's been listening to me misrepresent scientific ideals for 7 months, and he still hasn't, like, given up on me yet. Salud. I really appreciate it. Tech loving mama. I love hearing stuff like that. And again, it's like, I'm so excited to see my daughter kind of have some of these like breakthrough moments. But Tech loving mama says, my youngest 13-year-old says his friend's, my youngest says he's his friend's techie. I think I understand what you mean. My youngest says he's his friend's tech and actually enjoys helping them learn how to do stuff. And I feel like there's going to be sort of another generational loop on this. I think we sold so many kids the idea of just like a glued shut tablet-y thing that, oh, you don't need to learn anything about it. And it does everything for you. And it just works. But I see something in like kids my daughter's age where as much as they are comfortable using touch interfaces, they're really curious about other tech metaphors. I was talking to my daughter's friend's dad at our little play date. It was so cute because it's these two kids playing out in a park and then it's the two dads. Like, hey, yeah, your kid likes my kid. I guess we're friends now. And it turns out he worked in post-production. So we had a really interesting conversation about entertainment. We don't have to get into that. But he was telling a story about his son going to this like little gaming convention, and even though he's got like an iPad, not the kid, but the family has an iPad and a Nintendo Switch, like his son is just obsessed with Game Boys and like the Nintendo 3DS. More analog-y, button-y, controller-y, tactile kinds of devices, and he's fixated on it. So much as, like, I might go in, like, pull my Nintendo 64 out of the garage just to let the kid play with it. And I feel like there's like, this little simmering undercurrent of kids playing with makerspaces and 3D printers and disassembling. I'm talking to my daughter's school about doing an electronics drive for families who maybe have some old PCs. If they're functional, we can try and fix them up and we can try and get them to people that really need a functional computer. But if they're non-functional, like if they're just too old or if they're falling apart, laptop that's totally been destroyed, we can let kids disassemble them. We can use those as examples to say like, hey, a computer is not a magic device that just feeds you Netflix. There are these components inside and they all have different jobs. And if you understand how this works, then you can do this and then you can repair that, or then you can build on this, or you can make your own things. And that to me is really exciting that I'm seeing 6 and 7-year-olds display an aptitude for touchscreen interfaces, but then are also very interested in more analog-y technologies. I left it downstairs. I pulled out my old Canon 7D, digital SLR, DSLR camera. It's like 15 years old now-ish. I don't remember exactly how old it is. That's my daughter's favorite camera. It's this giant magnesium frame, reinforced, weather-sealed monster truck of a camera. She can barely wrap her hands around all of the grips and controls, and it's difficult for her to hold it, let alone really operate this thing. But it's almost entirely mechanical. And she thinks that's insane. That she pushes a button and she hears a mirror go thwack, 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 thwack for multiple exposures. And each one of those is a picture. So she thinks it's hilarious. Like, she'll point it at me. It's got like an 8 frame per second buffer. So tack, 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 tack. And then there's like 50 photos of me going, trying to get the camera from her like it's a slideshow. But that the entire thing is so almost machined and mechanical is so much more interesting to her than a lot of these, like, you know, like a smartphone camera or some of my digital, like my mirrorless cameras. Like, they make little clicking noises and stuff, but nothing like the bolt action firing mechanism on a Canon 7D. So it's that kind of stuff. Like, once you expose some people to this, they kind of remember, they kind of like, oh yeah, we used to have this, or we could do that. Or it's like, we kind of wake up out of a fog. And I think that that kind of stuff is exciting, especially when you can share it with someone who didn't grow up with that kind of tech. They grew up with supposedly better tech. Owen's gone saying, yeah, I forgot about the EcoHub. Thanks. And it's half off. Oh, so it's on sale right now. That's great. Again, the DAC on the EcoHub is not going to displace like an Onyx or a Helm, but it is really good. It is going to best almost every single laptop headphone jack out there, except for some of the board manufacturers that are really including like that ESS hardware. And it's also kind of exciting because I believe this is Eco's own chip. I don't think they're using AKM, ESS, I'm missing one, or what's the other, like the one that's almost on every single lap motherboard. Because I almost always disable it on my motherboards, and I can't remember the company. Everyone here knows what I'm talking about, and I'm just babbling right now. But the Eco is pretty solid. It's really good. And agreed, Tech Potato, if it doesn't have an SD card reader and Ethernet, I'm not interested. I feel like laptops should never have given up on useful ports. I'm right there with you. How does the hub work with the Steam Deck? It works pretty well. It does detect as an audio device. As close as I could measure, I do not believe that the Steam Deck is properly putting out 24-bit audio to connected devices, except for maybe in its desktop mode. If someone else has managed to get that to play properly, please let me know, because I have not found where these crazy like 24-bit 96, 24, 192, 32-bit DACs, I don't believe are being fully utilized on Steam Deck. The thing about Steam Deck is that its headphone jack is pretty decent. I would only recommend adding additional audio processing hardware to a Steam Deck if you want to go wireless or if you've got to drive some really thirsty cans. Like if you need a better amp, then that would be a reason to maybe step up. But the headphone jack on the Steam Deck itself is better than functional. It's better than adequate. It's pretty solid. Tech Love and Mama, sorry if my comment was confusing. I'm multitasking. Absolutely. But so she says, I love that idea. We as techies kind of have something of a superpower here. And I know, you know, some of you are maybe not likely to engage like this, but like if you live next to a grade school or a middle school and you've got just some old gear, call them up. I'm looking at doing maybe my next round of getting rid of phones. Instead of going to a shelter or a charity, I might go to approach the teachers at the school and say, hey, I know we live in a nice area. My wife and I are house rich and cash poor to live in a place where we've got good schools for our daughter. But even in this community, I have to believe there are some folks struggling out there, and I've got some TCLs, I've got some OnePluses, I've got some Motorolas. Without making too much noise about like someone getting singled out for not having the money to own a nice phone, we could maybe set up sort of a double blind through the school and see if there are families who are struggling to have like a Chromebook or a tablet or a phone or something for their kids. Like, I'm not going to use these TCLs. They're just kind of sitting here. It's a communication device. It's not the fanciest, but it's eminently functional and it will keep you connected to your family. And you could just have it. Or I could give it to you and you could sell it, get some cash, and then buy something else. But I would feel better about like that having contributed to someone's well-being than just like, I put it on eBay and I got 25 whole dollars. Doesn't work for me. I don't feel like that's appropriate to do with review devices. But if I kind of like spread the wealth, then I feel better about stockpiling so much potential e-waste, but getting it out into people's hands. Have any insight into smartphone company transition? I saw they were number 5 in sales just behind Oppo in second quarter 23, and I've never heard of them. I don't know that name. Oh, sorry, Ron. I think you stumped me on that one. I don't think I've heard of or used any of their products. So I'll look them up later, though, and maybe we could reach out and we can chat. I'm always kind of interested in, like, if a company is starting to climb the ranks, are they a subsidiary of another brand, or are they something kind of fresh? So I'll look them up. We'll see if it's something kind of cool. Excuse me. Oh, Gormlord. Yeah. I really like those Kano Raspberry Pi kits that kids can do. And me too. It's like Legos for grownups. The Raspberry Pis are a lot of fun. I've got some old Nooks. And see, that's the other thing too, is like, I've got an old Nook. That's not a crazy powerful machine. Like, the two of them that I've got are like also like Celerons. They're really not going to be things I'm going to be doing a whole lot with. The one of the ideas was like, I could turn this into a Steam Link box, but I also have a Nook Extreme behind my TV. So I absolutely do not need to put an even lower power computer behind my TV on top of my high power computer behind my TV. But for doing office work, like bolt it to the back of a monitor in like the school office and they just need another machine. Like, I'm trying to tell them, like, you could just have it. And I'll just slowly back away and fade and throw a smoke bomb and just vanish. So again, there's always that weirdness when you like approach a school and you're like, yeah, I've just got all this old technology. And they're like, oh, but what are you doing? And I have to show them like, no, I do this for a living and companies send me stuff and I don't keep all of it. A lot of it I have to send back. But when I get something like a Celeron, you could use this. I know you can. Who's your IT department? Let me chat and we could figure this stuff out. And I think that would be a better help for people in your community that maybe need that extra assistance. So some really fun stuff. It feels good. I like that. That's the kind of stuff that makes me that makes me feel better about like my current place as like a technology journalist, editorialist, influencer, whatever it is that I'm supposed to call myself these days. So folks, science is rad. I'm gonna go ahead and start wrapping this show up. I really wish I could tell you more of what's going to be going on, but I'm probably going to be doing, I don't think it's going to be out this week, but I am going to be shooting a comparison on the Rokid glasses. So the Rokid and X-Reel glasses and the Rokid and X-Reel brains. And I think those will probably end up coming out next week. So stay tuned for that. I have so many thoughts on devices like Pixel Fold and Pixel Tablet. Yesterday, I was just up in my snark. I was really up in my feels and feeling really snarky. And I was using the Pixel Tablet to play Bloons TD6. I love tower defense games, but I've never really gotten into Bloons too hard. But now it's on Netflix and you don't have any microtransactions. It's pretty great. So I'm playing Bloons TD6. And I realized, like, I'm only on playing on easy. I'm not doing anything crazy. But I'm at like round 180 on this Tensor 2, and it is now starting to struggle, but I've genuinely filled the entire screen with units. And so I put out a short just making fun of people like, oh, Tensor 2, you can't even like game on it. It's like too not good enough, and it's not powerful enough, and you need like a Snapdragon 8 Gen 7, and that's like gooder, or an iPhone, because it's more powerful. And you're like, I'm so done with people that are just whipping out AnTuTu scores. And you're like, you're doing worse than not contributing. You're actively misrepresenting the power and the performance of these crazy pocket computers when I can pick up a Pixel Fold and it's not good enough as compared to another gooder phone. And yet, like, I am crushing audio editing on it. I'm crushing video rendering on it. I'm doing things with it, not just, I open it up and I watch a movie on it and the Tensor 2 isn't good enough. And like, I'm so over what passes for this kind of tech. It's so bad. Real quick, I'm going to answer this tip and then we're wrapping up the I'm going to answer this question and then we're wrapping up the show. What other tower defenses have you enjoyed? So like a lot of folks in terms of mobile, I loved me some original Plants vs. Zombies. I thought that was a great, what do we call this? A gateway drug to the wonderful world of strategy and tower defense. For Android devices, it kills me. It guts me that the two best mobile tower defense games I think I've ever played were the Sentinel games, Sentinel 3 and Sentinel 4. And the developer just vanished. It just completely imploded. I believe Sentinel 3 was available for PC. I don't know about Sentinel 4. But sci-fi, action combat, those games were incredible. And now there is no way to play them. I have old phones on that shelf. Hilariously, my Razer phone, my Razer Phone 2, excuse me, still has them saved, and I will power up that phone just to relive some of those heyday moments of playing Sentinel on my phones. Now I'm playing a lot of Bloons TD6. You can get that completely for free. Not for free. You're paying for it, but you can get it as part of your Netflix subscription, and there are no additional microtransaction-y things to buy. But it's just Netflix has its own little contained version of Bloons TD6. And then across mobile and desktop, I love the Anomaly series. The Anomaly series is reverse. It's tower offense. So aliens have landed on Earth and their organic structures are taking over cities. And you pilot a little convoy of vehicles to try and destroy their towers. So it's the reverse of tower defense. Instead of enemies are on a path and you set up towers to kill the enemies, you are the entities on a path and you've got to take out all of the towers. It is such a fun twist on tower defense. And then I still feel like one of the all-time best tower defense games, it's only available on PC, is Defense Grid. Defense Grid 1 and 2. I actually got to do some of the voiceover recording engineering. I didn't direct the sessions, but I was sort of in the room to tell actors what to do along with the producer and pushing record. But who was in that voice cast? Jennifer Hale, Ming-Na Wen, Alan Tudyk. Alan Tudyk is in Defense Grid 2. He is amazing. If you don't know who Alan Tudyk is, then you're really missing out. He is one of the most gifted and talented ensemble performers I think the world has ever seen. And his voice work is incredible because he's done so many voice roles that you would never have known that it was him. But he was in Defense Grid 2. And so I have a photo of him, like, just fresh out of the session. He's still kind of sweaty from having been in the booth and yelling a whole bunch. But took the photo, him and me, Alan Tudyk. I got to, like, touch him. Really cool. Really cool guy, and just one of truly one of the most gifted performers that I've ever put in front of a microphone for doing voice work like that. But my personal feelings of getting to meet a celebrity aside, Defense Grid is a phenomenal tower defense game. Defense Grid 1 will work on touch interfaces, so if you play it on something like a Surface or like my Robo Incala, it plays pretty well on that. You can do sort of touch to control it. Defense Grid 2 is much more controllery based, but both of them are super, super, super good. Here, let me get this out of the way there. Yeah, Steve Pogue, Tower Offense. Yes. Pick up, there I think are four Anomaly games. And like you can regularly find them if you hit like a Humble Bundle. I got them all on a Humble Bundle for like $10. And they are so good. But like both of them, like you can get them on Android, and I play them a lot on my Steam Deck. And again, they're just like comfort food for me at this point. I've played through every single campaign several times over, and I'll still just fire up like, I don't know, I just kind of feel like Anomaly 2 again. Let's do that. It's so fun. Oh, yeah. Oh, Tudyk is brilliant. What a character actor. He is incredible. I mean, like Firefly and Dollhouse. And of course, he's the main reason Ron Guido. We love Resident Alien. First of all, for the depiction of native peoples in that show is just wonderful for like my wife and I, who grew up in New Mexico and have experienced sort of this cultural influence over, over our lives. But then also Alan Tudyk is hilarious. I love seeing Alan Tudyk, and you can tell he's having a lot of fun with that role. So, we've gone from being just right on time. Baseball Super, that was the best question to have me just ramble out another 10 minutes. I'm going to take a drink of water, and we are outie. Excuse me, I almost spat water right through. Thorough answer. I'm glad I could contribute. I mean, tower defense is... that is just me scratching the surface of my obsession with tower defense games. But those are some of like the ones that really spark, like... the Marie Kondo, they really spark the joy. So try some of them if you haven't heard of them or anything. Like, go for it. There's some really, really good stuff. Oh, Simon says Hypno, Tucker and Dale versus Evil. So good. That's another movie I have to watch at least once a year. It is awesome. So fun. Alan Tudyk is in that too. So next week, we're going to continue our love affair with Alan Tudyk and my inability to properly describe advances in material science. I don't know. We'll see. It could be crazy. But again, folks, I always appreciate all the support, the people that have been subscribing, tier one subs on Twitch, all the people that come to join this conversation and you're writing comments and sharing these videos. Excuse me. Sorry. My voice is really starting to go on me here. All of that is so greatly appreciated. And like I started this podcast out, it is to wrap it up with the same plea. If there's a content creator that you care about, it's time to start finding ways to support them out of just passively viewing on YouTube. It's time to find ways to support them outside of just occasionally clicking on an article in an algorithmic feed that was shovel fed to you from Google or Facebook or Twitter or wherever. And it's time to start looking at the alternatives to, or at least the fallbacks, to the ratcheted social media that is becoming so toxic today. My weapon of choice is Mastodon, because on Mastodon there is no algorithm standing on my neck. And when I post the same content to Mastodon and to Threads and to Blue Sky and to Twitter, I find real human interactions on Mastodon where I kind of get a couple likes on all of these other platforms. If the point of social media is to build that community and to have these conversations and to interact with real people, I do not care about the internet points I get on Threads. I have all these followers on Threads. No conversations. No, there is no interaction. I have 16,000 followers on Twitter. A couple likes, maybe a share or two. I have less than 600 followers on Mastodon, conversations all day. I cannot express to you how refreshing and how freeing it is to not have an algorithm standing on your neck and to find people who really geek out about this stuff. It's the best. So folks, I want you to have an amazing week. I want you to do awesome with your technology. I want you to be awesome with your technology. I want you to take care of yourselves so you can keep taking care of others. Catch you back here next week. Be safe. I love y'all. I'll catch you back.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content,
or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.